This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Next up, it's a Plains FM feature interview, keeping you in touch with the people and events happening in our Canterbury community.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Peter Lum.
Yeah.
So, according to my research, you were born in Prague, you grew up in Canada, and
yeah.
you're currently based in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
You have a PhD in political philosophy from Harvard.
Yeah.
And was an associate professor in human rights and philosophy. In 2003, you transitioned to documentary filming, focusing on human rights issues. Notable works are Bride Kidnapping in, I can't pronounce that word.
Kyrgyzstan,
On a Tightrope, Letters to the President, Back to the Square, and the Burma Storybook. Your films have featured in over 250 film festivals worldwide, including Sundance and Berlin. It's a real pleasure to have you here. I hope I have those facts right. And thank you very much for joining us at Plains FM.
Thanks. My pleasure. It's wonderful to be here.
Good. So is this your... you've spent a bit of time in New Zealand because the film that is airing tonight for the premiere and there's the opening festival, I Am the River and I Am Me, took 4 years of filming in New Zealand, was it?
No, not four. The project took 4 years from start to finish. But it's actually for filming, it was the shortest one, one of the shortest ones we've ever done. We only spent 4 months filming. For us, that's really short.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So just to go back in time just a little bit, can you tell us about your journey going from academia to documentary filmmaking?
Yeah, you said transition. It wasn't more, well, not really a transition. It was more like a parachute leap.
Right.
Just kind of cutting the cords and just jumping. So, I did a PhD in political theory, political philosophy, and I became an academic, and I didn't like that. Studying was wonderful, but being an academic was depressing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of just doing stuff for your own career, writing articles and papers, and it was very self-involved. I loved teaching, but the research part and the careerist part of it, I was like, oh, this is terrible. What do I do?
Yeah.
So I thought I would become a photojournalist. So you have long summers in the university business, and I was working for the George Soros University, Central European University in Budapest. So it covered all of Central Asia, the former Soviet places. So I could travel to all these countries.
Wow.
So I would spend the summer. I went to Tajikistan and hitchhiked to Afghanistan and taking photos, thinking I'm going to be a photojournalist, war photographer sort of thing. And then I would meet people who would do that work. And I thought, oh, God, that's terrible. I don't want to do this. They'd all be like, have you been to the bombing? It's like, no, why would you want to go to a bombing? Horrible. Who do you work for? Like, I don't work for anybody. Why would you want to do that either?
Yeah.
So then I became a filmmaker because I found a story about bride kidnapping in Kyrgyzstan. I was out there as an academic. I had a sabbatical, and I was supposed to be doing research at the time on Islamic extremism. And they don't have any in Kyrgyzstan. But it was post 9/11, so everybody wanted to study this stuff. So I would be waiting around to interview some of these supposed extremists who weren't really very extreme. And I'd say, how'd you meet your wife? And they say, I kidnapped her.
Right.
And that's how I learned about the subject, that 40% of rural marriages are done through kidnapping in Kyrgyzstan. And then nobody was working on the subject. So I did a lot of heartbreaking interviews with women who had been kidnapped. And then I thought, I'll do it as a photo essay. And then I thought, no, I'm going to make a film. I didn't have any experience. And I just did. And it worked out beautifully. So I realized I was kind of natural born filmmaker, even though I didn't really know it.
So it's your role that you are behind the camera.
Yeah. I film everything. Yeah.
So you are the film man as well as director.
Yeah, and I work together with my partner who's not here. I said she's doing her hair for the evening career. But we work there. We're a couple. She's officially Corinne van Echerat, and she's Dutch and she's the producer. But we're a couple, so we basically do everything together.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So we're on set directing together, basically.
Okay. Does she have to sort of rein you in on a lot of your wild ideas and things?
No,
like that?
No, actually, most of the ideas come from her. She's much more creative than I am.
Right.
So I was always doing direct cinema verite, right? And she's the creative one. And now we put these two things together, and it kind of is kind of neat what comes out of it.
Fantastic. Yeah. And how is it working with your life partner?
It's good. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to do it at first. I was a real lone wolf when I was working at first. I would just do everything myself. And we had fallen in love and just met.
So you didn't kidnap her?
No, I didn't kidnap. I tried to flee.
She kidnapped you.
No, I was commitment phobic for whatever, for longer story. We don't have time for that. But yeah. but we had just met, and then the revolution in Egypt, the Arab Spring just exploded in Tahrir Square. So I went. Mm-hmm. I had good context for a really good story. I just left, and then she followed me. So she wouldn't let me leave. So then we lived together in Egypt, and then we started working together. She was teaching young artists to do self-portraits. And that was a time before selfies. Mm-hmm. So this was all new, and people were allowed to film on the street for the first time. So I helped her with that, and then we made our first film from that, and then we just started working together. So. Yeah. And every film, it's easier and easier. So, yeah, we like it a lot, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so how did you find that transition moving from... So when you say, like moving from academia, which is like, it's very safe.
It's safe.
It's very, very
indoors.
Yeah,
totally safe.
And then you're out. But not only that, like, you've got a camera. So I'm a bit of a photographer myself. So
yeah.
I always find it very exposing to have a camera in these spaces. So is it just... how do you kind of approach your subjects in that way?
Oh, yeah, maybe that's a nice question. Yeah, for sure. There's a element of, well, I don't know if it's extroversion, but basically, yeah, as soon as you start pointing a camera into people, you have to be out there, right?
Mm.
But photography and filmmaking are quite different. With photography, you're looking to grab something or capture something. So there's all this kind of waiting until you... And that's changed since it's digital. Now you don't bother. Yeah. Now you just do machine gun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one reason why I stopped liking photography, too. It was funny. I bought a film camera. I started with that. And then when I bought digital cameras were just coming out, and I bought one of those. And then all of a sudden, the photography wasn't as good. It was like, what's wrong with this? But with filmmaking, you're looking for story. So the real art of it is to get close to people. And that means, above all, you have to be really open-hearted. And so it's a real animal thing. People have to feel, oh, you're safe to be around. Or I like being around you. You're not going to hurt me. Actually, it's the opposite. It's going to be a friendship.
Yeah.
And that's, for us, is the real key to filmmaking.
Yeah. 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 So a lot of time, you're entering into these situations. I mean, I imagine the sort of, for example, like the bride kidnapping would have been a difficult subject to get into and to get people to talk about, or was there...
No, that was different. That was actually the easiest film I ever made. It's kind of, it was funny. I was living in Kyrgyzstan, and I was living with friends out there, and then my friend's wife became my assistant, and she was excellent with people, and I was just a beginning filmmaker who didn't really know how crucial that was. So it was kind of luck or intuitive, whatever. So that film was hard to find out when we filmed the kidnappings in real time. So, which was controversial at the university. Some people wanted to throw me out because of that. But later I got a medal from the government of Kyrgyzstan for human rights, because the film's been shown in schools all over the country. So that was all okay. But it was hard to find the kidnappings. But then once you got the access to follow these boys who were doing this, or these families, that was basically just, I didn't know what I was doing, to be honest. I was just a beginner, but it was just like, don't drop the camera and be kind of quiet. And then you just realize there's this energy thing where you kind of don't be intrusive, even though it's such intense moments to do your work. But then later the films became harder, because those are really dramatic events. So you kind of have to screw it up.
Yeah.
But when you're doing more creative storytelling, where there's not really so much a story in front of you, that's where the art of storytelling becomes, it's a craft.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. I mean, our river film, it's nothing happens. It's just a road trip down the Whanganui River for 5 days with 12 people. So
yes,
that's the story. So,
yeah.
And then beautiful things do happen. But if
absolutely,
you're...
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 Let's talk about the film, because it's fascinating. So not only do you have some very powerful local people in there as well.
Yeah.
I noticed that there's an Australian, an Aboriginal from Australia has come over and joined you too. That's an interesting choice.
The story worked out this way. So my wife had read about the Whanganui River getting legal personhood. First river in the world that's recognized as a legal person by law, which is fascinating for us. Was fascinating for us. Not only that, it's also recognized as an individual spiritual being by New Zealand law. Also, wow, that's fascinating. So it kind of pulled us in the story. I mean, and so by coincidence, we met a commissioning editor who commissions the short films in the Netherlands. And my wife pitched the story to me, liked it. So that gave us enough money to come over here and make a short reportage. It's called We Are the River. You can watch it online. It's 15-minute little reportage film. And we came to Whanganui. We didn't know anybody. And the funny thing was my wife said, well, she was like thinking, okay, who do we know in New Zealand? She's like, well, I don't know anybody in New Zealand, but I know somebody in Australia. And I was like, well, it's a little bit further away. But she says, no, but this person we know from Australia, she had a roommate from New Zealand. And so she contacted her. And she said, yeah, my roommate from New Zealand was actually from Whanganui. And so gave us the contact for his parents who were still there. And we contacted them, and they lived right on the river. And they had a piece of land that was right next door to the land of the main chief in Whanganui. So right. Uncle John Mahi. And they were doing restoration of land. And they had also worked with him. So that was the connection. So we met them. And they liked us, and then and there was an initial test too. They invited a Maori friend of theirs along to do something or other, and we're in the car just quiet. And in the end, our new friend said, "Well, I think they should probably talk to Uncle John, right?" So we were like, "When do we pitch the idea, we don't do any of that." And then so we were fortunate enough the second day in Whanganui to already have an appointment with the chief.
Wow.
And then we have the test, which I never had before. And I don't know if you had, but we walked into his office. And he just looked at me, and he looked through me and into me. And I never had that experience before, that someone is really scanning your soul in 10 seconds. And then he starts laughing.
Right. Yeah.
So it ended up well. He said, oh, come on. And he said, oh, you really look like people who can't be trusted. And then we told him, we want to make this short to understand how a river can be a spiritual being. Can you help us out? And he said, only one person can help you. So he picks up the phone and calls Ned.
Right.
Who's the protagonist or our main ally in the film, a Maori community leader. And then Ned comes over to our Airbnb on the river the next day, and he says, okay, I've been voluntold to work with you. Don't really like cameras, but I have to do this now. And he says, I'm going camping with my grandson over the weekend. You want to come? And so we made a beautiful short film together, just like that. And normally, and the story goes, to get access is often very challenging, particularly with indigenous stories, right? But this was really easy. And then while we're filming, Ned told us, he said, there was an Australian artist here who wants to bring a First Nations Australian, an Aboriginal elder, down the river. Wouldn't that be a nice film for you guys to work together? And we said, yeah, that's wonderful. We thought that was going to be like 6 weeks later, and then COVID happens.
Mm.
So that's how the story came. It was basically Ned's invitation, his idea. And then over a period of, during COVID, we had basically different candidates, First Nations Australians who were going to come. And then for whatever different reasons over 2 years, those kind of things shifted. And we ended up with Brendan, who's a little older than me. He's an elder, and he comes along with his daughter. And their river is dying in Australia.
Right.
So they want to learn from the Whanganui. So it was beautiful, to have two perspectives like this and to see the similarities and differences in Indigenous wisdom, yeah.
In a lot of countries, I think New Zealand is a bit unique in the fact that it's the country that where the sort of the Indigenous people are having much more of a say in government,
a lot more
sort of power in the culture. And a lot more sort of a sort of alive in that respect, and I think it is something which is coming back over the last couple of years.
Although there's real worries now with this new government that there's going to be real pushbacks on that, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're hoping. I personally hope that they've got enough of a sort of foot in that they've had from previous that this is not going to happen. Enough support. There's enough people that would do it. But so, for example, like Matariki is the first Indigenous festival to be come out in the world in a long time.
It's we're really fortunate and we're aware of that gift that the Maori have let us in and been willing to share their stories and wanting to share their wisdom with us and share their friendship. So, but that's been a real gift, and we see that gift also now as the responsibility. There's this beautiful Maori word. I don't know if you know. It's called kopapa. And kopapa means, right, everybody knows that here, but for me it's new, right?
Yeah.
What's your moral and spiritual purpose and why you're doing something? And get in line with that.
Yeah.
And so that's really beautiful. And so we've already taken that to heart, and now we're seeing, well, okay, what can we do with this film? And so we're now in the midst of setting up a big impact campaign as well with it at different levels to do grassroots community screenings, to do education, and also to do things on a policy level in different countries around the world. Because the rights of nature is a huge movement, particularly in the Netherlands, also in Ireland, where you're from.
Yeah,
They want to put that in the, I don't know if you know, but they want to.
I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah, they want to do a constitutional amendment to really put it in the Constitution. So it's super exciting.
How has your approach to document filming been impacted or sort of directed by your experience in academia through the philosophy and the human rights?
Zero.
Zero, right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
No. I could give a more sophisticated answer than that.
Yeah.
Basically, it's the work that I used to do in the past was all brainy work, all intellectual, very little feeling, very little emotions or intuitions. And now this exact opposite.
Mm.
So it's using a basically different part of yourself, really. And the intuitive creativity is totally different as well. Not to say that what's most similar to academia and filmmaking is actually the editing, is because that's basically an abstract reasoning function, right? How to put something together. So it's not so different than writing a paper or an essay or a dissertation, except it's with pictures and sound. Except the thing is that there's a simplicity in storytelling that to be really emotionally effective always has to be kind of distilled down that way. And that's really different than academia, which is usually often about noise.
Well, using words. Complex language.
But even if it's not complex, it's words, it's all this talking. Yes. And we're interested in creating an emotional experience for you in all our films.
Core seems to be the human, and the human aspect around it. So to have studied human rights,
that's still abstract. I mean, the reason why all my films and working with my wife too have been, since we're together, all been about injustice.
Mm.
That's the common thread on all of them, and that comes from because I was born in Czechoslovakia, and we had to flee from when the Russians invaded. So that's the core of why I'm interested in stories like that. But that's kind of the subjects, but they're not abstract. We're always trying to make films that are universal, that are not bound in time. So it's not reportage or reporting. It's something different. It's storytelling that you're looking for universal things in a way. So, and then because we see documentary filmmaking really as an art. So you're struggling to try to make something timeless. That's kind of what you're trying to do.
Yeah. And are you doing all the editing yourself then as well?
No. We work with we work with big teams of people now. So I've taken a step back from that, even though it's quite difficult. And usually I want to come in. And
I mean, editing is a real art to itself as well. Mm-hmm.
I compare it to, I don't know, being a good carpenter or a real good craftsman of any kind.
Yeah.
That it's really something that it's, I have real respect for it the longer I do it. Yeah. Yeah.
And then so with the film being on the river for 5 days, that must have had its own technical issues.
Yeah. I mean, it's based don't fall in the water, bringing up batteries. And it's challenging because it's two canoes. So we have a big, huge camera, but it didn't really, you realize that on the go, it doesn't really work because you're going to tip the canoe over as soon as you move. So, but that's basically a lot of logistical planning. And then we had he's here actually tonight too. Richard Seide is a wonderful filmmaker from New Zealand who was our drone operator and second camera.
Right.
So I had people helping me too. Yeah. Mm. But that's all planning. And then what's nice about the film is it's only two canoes. So we decided with my wife that, we have to include everybody in the film and you can't hide or pretend that they're not there. And then, so that's was from necessity, but also fun from storytelling because we wanted to have an idea of unity in the film, so that everybody needs to unite to solve these problems that we have in the world. And so everybody in the film becomes a character, so including the dog.
And including the river as well, obviously.
And the river is actually the main character of the film.
And so how personally do you feel, do you relate to the river? How does it affect you? Like, how do you communicate to the river? Do you almost...
It's not like that. But there's a real... what we wanted to do was... to step into we can't appropriate a worldview that's not ours. So it's a conversation of what we're trying to learn.
Hmm.
It's kind of common sense too. You have to approach everything with respect and love. And so part of that has been to try to see, how could you understand the river as this spiritual being through cinematic language or storytelling? How do you do that? And it's actually not so difficult.
Hmm.
It just takes a lot of patience, a lot of care. And, but yeah, yeah, But you have to see the film.
I will. I am looking forward to it. But yourself, do you consider yourself to be a spiritual person?
This is a long question. Yes and no. Certainly not religious at all. But I mean, I've been doing yoga for 25 years and a lot of meditation, things like this. So yeah, it's something, of course, I'm deeply interested in. I tend not to talk about it too much because it's annoying.
No, I get you.
But for sure. So the film's supposed to, and we're basically, I'm more than anything in general interested in spiritual cinema. So someone like Tarkovsky is one of my heroes. Is that basically, I think any great art is supposed to transcend itself and point to something bigger than you, to create a feeling of awe or respect, and then how you fill that in is your business.
Yeah.
Right.
So. Yeah. And so, would you say this is an optimistic film?
Yeah, all our films are hopeful. By definition, otherwise you shouldn't be making films, no? Doing anything.
Some people like to have a little bit misery porn, as I like to call it.
But you heard what you said, the second word, porn, right? Yeah. So it's like, what's that for? Why don't you just leave people alone?
I know, but also, for example, I grew up watching David Attenborough all my life. Massive inspiration for me.
Okay,
and, sure. I unfortunately just can't, it's too much of an emotional thing for me. I can't watch his later work because it is just very doom.
I guess so, sure. I could see your point.
Yeah.
No, but this is a hopeful story by definition, right? And the Maori are such beautiful examples for us also of resilience.
Mm.
Right? Because you'll see it in the film from Brendan, the Australian as well, that part of being on the river is also a healing experience. That's what it's also for. Yeah. That the river is, you go there to, you know, unburden yourself from your suffering. And that's kind of, it works in a very strange, organic, natural way in the film, you see. And but despite that, there's real deep stories of pain in the film, but what's extraordinary about it is that there's a gentleness in how that pain is expressed, that it's not expressed with, we've been harmed and so therefore we're overcome by resentment or vengeance or hate. To the contrary, it's actually overcoming that, and that's what's quite extraordinary about the history in the film itself. But more than anything is the open-hearted generosity of all the people that we work with, especially the Maori.
Yeah,
and that's really, really special, because that's so inspiring. Is that and that's our deep belief as filmmakers now with all the problems we're confronting, because everybody's separated into these identity debates or national debates. The political situation is like that. And also in the Netherlands now, our new government, it's like people more and more inward looking. And the film is actually just the opposite. It's like, if we would all unite together, then a lot of these problems could be solved.
Talking to Alex in a previous interview, the founder of the festival, one of the big themes he wanted to talk about was how building communication, building that dialogue between people, and so it's not just against sort of governments at the moment. This movie is about communicating with nature, which is also a massive
for sure. And so
And so for you personally, then what does the future hold for you? Then what's next for you?
Oh well, we're always working on a lot of different things, kind of nature freelance work, and also because of COVID, we've just finished another film now that we worked on for 7 years. It's set in Cape Verde. It's also this similar theme about our relation to nature. So it's a poem about our world spinning out of control. So, and how we have to reconnect with nature, particularly a feeling of awe and respect to the natural world around us before it's too late.
Yeah. So how do you even begin to approach something like that?
It started as a music film, and then it evolved into, it was supposed to be a music film about the longing for home, because that's really strong in Cap. I don't know if you know any of the music from Cap Verde, Cesaria Avoria. She's the most famous one. So it's all about this feeling. They call it saudade, which is feeling of longing for something you're missing. But it's both it's both melancholy and optimistic at the same time. So that's how it started. It was a film about longing for home. And then we realized, we're actually losing our global collective home. Let's make a film about that. Mm. And it's neat because Cape Verde is known as the place where hurricanes are born.
Right.
So that becomes the metaphor for the whole film, that there's this storm happening around all of us. Yeah.
Stunning. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to begin to wrap up, because this has been amazing. I know you got a big day ahead.
Okay.
But I'm going to put you on the spot though.
Yeah.
So what was the first sort of documentary that you saw that really that really grabbed you, that that really made an influence on your life that you still sort of think about and resonate?
Yeah, that's nice because I'm self-taught, right? So I didn't go to film school. Mm. And so if there's any filmmakers out there listening to this interview, I say, don't go to film school. Above all, what you have
go
to do.
Go to Harvard and study
politics. No, you have to do that either. But the big thing is really it's just conquer your fears and just it's a practical craft that you can learn by doing. And for me, the biggest thing was going into this kind of freelance artistic world is to conquer your fears of insecurity. That's really the biggest one. So my film school was actually going to cinemas. I live right next door to a Repertory Cinema, so I'd go to the movies every night. Mm. But so the films that really inspired me at first were above all fiction films, and then later documentaries. Yeah, so you have to educate yourself by seeing all the classics. So all the classics in cinema verite, stuff by the Maisels brothers or Frederick Wiseman. But maybe one of the earliest films that inspired was Agnes Varda, The Gleaners. Beautiful, beautiful film. Yeah, yeah. Recommend that to anybody.
All right. Yeah. So would this be in like your early years or would have been? And in the last sort of 10 years then as Documentary Film Festival has really evolved into this real art.
Yeah.
And blockbuster films made out of it and big sections, Oscar, a lot of Oscars.
Yeah.
Of the big ones of the modern, besides your own films, of course, what would be a sort of standout film for you as your sort of your favorite one?
There's never a favorite. There's so many films all the time. I mean, you're Irish. I mean, maybe the film that touched me the most in the last year or two has been an Irish film called The Quiet Girl. Which is a beautiful film. Very simple story. It's a fiction film, but very beautiful story. Simple story is a girl who's not loved is sent to some relatives for the summer. Mm. That's it. Just heartbreaking film.
Oh, totally. It's
really lovely film.
Yeah. I've not heard that one. I'll have to check it out. And then, you've touched on it, the advice that you would give to young filmmakers is just to get out there and do it, conquer your fears and just get to do it. Is there anything else that you'd like to...
Yeah, well, I guess it's... It's also to understand what kind of profession it is. It's a difficult profession. So I compare it to if you're have a personality who'd like enjoy endurance running, that's the kind of personality that you need to survive in this business long term. Because there's a lot of people who make one film or two films and that's it. Because also the ability to find stories or that creativity is also difficult. That depends on the person. I'm not for my wife. She'll find a story like every 2 days. She comes up with a new subject. There's too many. So that's a gift. But the endurance to be able to basically not just dream stuff up, but to turn it into something concrete. Yeah, that takes a lot of persistence and determination and the feeling that, you kind of feel like you want this more than anything else. And that fire has to be there. Otherwise, go do something else. You'll be much happier.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a little bit like, maybe more but before I wanted to be a filmmaker, I had my fantasies as a graduate student to be a writer.
Right.
So I would I wrote a big collection of short stories, trying to get published and stuff. Nobody was really interested. A little bit encouraging, sort of, but, it was kind of, and then I realized, it's kind of depressing writing stories in your room all the time. But I wasn't really willing to confront that conclusion because I was still enamored with this romantic idea of being a writer.
Right.
But then I read Rilke, right? Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet, right? And he asked that question. He said, ask yourself deep down, is this something that you have to do or could you do something else?
Mm.
And I was like, shit. I could do something else.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I guess that's not really me. So you kind of have to ask that real question to yourself. And it doesn't have to be so radical extremes like, I have to do this. But that is really congruent. I talked about this cope-up idea, right? It's really congruent with really the fire that's really inside you. And if you find that, you'll be fine.
That's true. Yeah. And I think it is hard to find today, especially because we are just bombarded by so many things. So finding your own truth,
it's difficult. Yeah, and especially with the visual world now, you're so saturated with images and stuff all the time. Attention spans are declining, all that stuff. So long-term storytelling. Yeah, maybe we're dinosaurs a little bit too. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, Alex did mention, or it was Rachel that mentioned something about there's a genre coming up now called TikTok documentaries. So
which is the opposite what we're trying to do. Actually, it's funny because when you see our film, what we're trying to do our film is the exact opposite, to slow down time.
Yeah.
To make you really experience the slowness and power of a river and be with that. And that's kind of exact opposite of everything that's around us.
There is definitely a movement. I mean, as much as people's attention spans are going up, there is also this fear of like podcasts and things like that that are going into more long
form. For example,
sure,
how popular that is, right? Sure.
So which is a real relief. So
which is nice.
Yeah. So your film tonight is opening up the festival.
I'm not sure when this
is going to come out, but wish you the best of luck. And thank you so much for your time, and enjoy the rest
thank
of
you,
how long, much longer are you in New Zealand?
We're here to the 30th, the end of the month.
Well, enjoy your time here.
Thanks.
Have you got anything planned? Are you going to do anything?
No, we're actually really busy with just working on this impact campaign with the film, so lots of different meetings and ideas how to start cooking on this. We'll keep you posted.
Brilliant, all right, well thank you so much before we wrap up.
Please tell your viewers to look at our website, iamtheriver.org.
Brilliant. Yeah. All right. iamtheriver.org. Definitely check that out. It's a fascinating piece of work. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Plains FM featured interview, keeping you in touch with what's happening in our Canterbury community.